Good afternoon. So last time we talked about, I have an important thing we talked about that's not on here, which is multi-level feedback cues. So we talked about approximating SRTF with basically priority scheduling, where we adjust the priorities based on did you use your full-time slice or not? Where the idea is that we adjust, have different time slices at different priorities, because if you're high priority, you should be not running for very long. And we adjust what priority you're at based on how long you actually run, so you eventually end up alternating between two priorities that puts you at the right level. Then we talked about different scheduling goals. So we went back to our fairness idea and talked about simple schedulers and less simple schedulers that achieve fairness. So our simple way of achieving fairness is, well, one notion of fairness is if we have multiple choices, we choose everyone equally. And one way of doing that is to make a random choice. And we talked about the lottery scheduler, which is what you'll be implementing for the next assignment, as a way of doing that. And we can extend our random choice to have this different notion of fairness where everyone has a share they're entitled to. In the lottery scheduler, this is the number of tickets you get in the lottery. And the idea is that something that has twice the share gets to run twice as much. But we pointed out that the lottery scheduler, the way we talked about it, it's just running you when you're runnable. It doesn't actually give you any credit for things like, I can only run half the time. If you can only run half the time, you get to run less than half the time if you're competing with someone. Because when you can run, we will decide to run you or someone else evenly, basically. And that's that. So we had alternatives where we have a notion of fairness, which is how much do you have to use the CPU, and we can measure that, and we call that virtual time. So virtual time was this, how much CPU time have you taken? And if we want to be fair for that, we just look for who has used the least virtual time and run that. And this idea was basically Linux's completely fair scheduler was based on this idea of tracking virtual time, give the CPU whoever has the least virtual time. And there were some details with that for, well, how much credit do we want to give you for you weren't using the CPU for an hour? Does that mean that you have an hour of time that we need to make up to you or not? And the answer usually for like a desktop is no. So we're going to do something in between and make a deliberate choice about how much time we want to give you because you weren't using the CPU for a while. Limit that advantage. Then we talked very briefly about real-time schedulers, mostly to point out that if you have like actual deadlines, like physical deadlines, like the break needs to be activated in 10 milliseconds or bad things will happen, then the schedulers we talked about previously weren't the ones to use, and you should do something that pays attention to those deadlines. We mentioned if you're doing preemption, earliest deadline first does it. But the bigger thing is that, well, sometimes you can't meet all your deadlines. And if you have a system where, like, you're activating breaks, you want to figure that out before you deploy your code, not when it runs and the scheduler doesn't manage to do things fast enough. So any questions about anything we covered last time? So everyone's tentatively good with that. So just to mention, since the lottery scheduler assignment, that's next week. So things you need to do, track the number of ticks a process runs. Notably, this is the number of times it's scheduled. We don't care about partial time slices or anything like that. This is just how many times is it scheduled when we ask to schedule a process. Like, don't try to adjust for did it use a whole time slice? Was it scheduled because someone else went to sleep? Just count the number of times it's scheduled. And we have a system call to get info about what processes are running and how long they've run. So this is so we can actually test your code, because otherwise you like take out a stopwatch, and that seems awfully not very effective. and a way to set the number of tickets someone gets. And you have to make a pseudo-random choice weighted by tickets. I would note that there is no floating point in the XV6 kernel. If you try to use floating point, it won't work. Like, what consistently won't work. Not like will partially work. Like, it will crash every time. So don't do that. You have to use integer math. Okay, yes. So the question is, how can you do this in better than linear time? For making the pseudo-random choice, you can keep a tree-like data structure that lets you look up an interval. So like the data structure you want is something like a binary search tree where you can find the thing that's less than a number index. Now, the complicated part is maintaining that as ticket counts or runnable processes change, but there are things you can do which are better than linear time, at least most of the time. Which we are not going to have you do. You can just do the iterate through the process table like the current scheduler does to find the process you want. Okay, so that's all about scheduling. And we're going to move on to talking about threads. And we mentioned when we talked about multi-threaded processes that threads were the thing we scheduled. And if we have multi-threaded processes, we're going to have separate thread control blocks where we keep like registers, stack pointers, and so on, maybe some other information about the thread from the process control block where we keep information about the process, like where's the process's heap? What files does the process have open? Information which, if a process has multiple threads, is shared between all the threads. So this is a common design, and I think the main one our textbook talks about. There's other models for dealing with this. So what Linux does is Linux has a task structure, which has pointers to the address space in the open file list. And the idea is you can have two different tasks which have the same pointers. So a multi-threaded process is actually a bunch of tasks which have a pointer to the same thing for their address space in their open files list. And in fact, there's a system call called clone, where you just give the list, there's an argument where you specify what things you want to share. And this is, in fact, how Linux creates threads. So there's this system called clone. You specify what you want to share. If you specify certain things, it's equivalent to fork. If you specify sharing more things, you're creating a new thread for your process. Okay. So this is actually a relatively common design. And the big advantage is that in something like the Linux kernel, threads aren't special. They're just threads and processes are treated exactly the same. There's very little special handling for multiple threads in the same process. Okay. And we're going to talk about threads that work in either the thread control block way, where the operating system tracks it, or this task way. And these are kernel threads. The OS scheduler knows about threads and deals with them. There's an alternate design, which we will not talk about except right now, where there's user space library code that handles threading. So the kernel runs a process, and a library in the process figures out what thread to run. And you have like two schedulers. So you have the kernel scheduler decides what process to run, and you have a scheduler in the process which decides what thread to run. This is not a currently common choice. It historically has been common, mostly because if you want to use multiple cores, you can do it, but it's pretty awkward to make that work. Okay. So we have threads. You know what they are. But one thing we're going to want to know is, why would we use threads? And there's two types of reasons we're going to talk about using threads. So one is to do different things at once, which we'll call concurrency. Like, I have a web server. I need to handle different requests at the same time. And I'm going to do that with multiple threads because that's a nice convenient way of doing that. Or I have multiple pages in my web browser. I'm going to have one thread to handle each of them. So we're doing similar things, but the threads are not part of the same operation. And we have parallelism, where we have one task we want to do, but we want to use more resources for it. So like I have multiple cores, and I want to do a simulation using all the cores and not just one. And we have a life assignment coming up where that will be the goal. So there's one task. Now, we're going to use the POSIX API for threads. So this is going to use pthreads. So here's the most basic threading function we're going to care about, which is pthread create. We need to create a new thread. And fortunately, there's nothing like fork here, nothing so confusing. There's a create a thread function. And it takes an identifier. So this pthread t is our equivalent of a process ID. So it's the ID for a thread. And pthread create takes a pointer to one as an argument and fills it in with the ID of the thread. It also takes a function to run. In this case, I have pythread, which is going to start running the compute py function, and listthread, which is going to start running the print class list function. And we have some additional null arguments. So the first one are thread attributes. So these are extra settings about what our thread should do. If you specify null, you just say, I want all the defaults. I don't have any special settings for these threads. And we have a function argument, which is going to be passed to the function. So our compute py function and print cast list functions take a void star that's required, and we have to specify what is that void star. We're specifying null because we don't really care. And so this code will start these two threads. And like with fork, once you start them, they're going to run eventually whenever the scheduler gets to them. And they'll run at the same time as this code in the dot, dot, dot. OK, questions? Yes?
So will each thread that you create run the dot, dot, dot code as well?
The question is, will each thread you create run the dot, dot, dot code? No. This is not like fork. They run this function, and when that function returns, they're done. Other questions? Yeah.
So they're kind of like running in the background, and then like the dot, dot, dot is like continuing.
So the question is, they're running in the background while the dot, dot, dot runs? That's one way of thinking about it, yes. OK. So now that we know how pthread create works, let's look at an example here. So here I have I print about to start thread, I create a thread, I print done starting thread, and I return from main. And in the thread, I call it, have this print message function, which prints in the thread. When I run this on my machine, I get the output in the thread only 4% of the time. So what happened? Why 96% of the time in the thread is not outputted? Return, so the question is, did I return before the print finished? So which print and which return?
So the return zero.
So
return zero finished before the print message.
Yeah. So your theory is that this return finished before this print happened. And that's what's going on. And what's confusing is, like, why does this matter? Well, returning from main exits the entire process, not just your thread. So we return from main, and main's return zero finished. Therefore, all the threads in the process were destroyed. That exiting the process destroys all its threads. That's how POSIX has chosen to make this work, even if there's others remaining. And we had this 4% of the time, because sometimes this is our timeline. Our main does the printf, the pthread create, the second printf, and returns. Sometimes the print message, this yellow box, was moved over a little bit because of how the scheduler worked. Scheduler, you know, got scheduled a little earlier, or maybe our main thread had to get slowed down a bit because something else got scheduled. So it just depended on exactly what the scheduler did, what our output was. And we call this a race condition, because these two threads are racing, and depending on the result of that race, we get different outputs. So we see our inconsistent outputs. So how can we fix that? And we're going to need something equivalent to, like pthread creates equivalent to fork. We're going to need the equivalent to wait PID. That's one way of fixing it, and that's pthread join. So pthread join is like wait PID. It takes a thread ID to wait for and a place to put its return value. In the case of this thread, the return value is what it actually returns from its starting function. In this case, I specify null. I don't care what it returned. Just wait for it. Yes?
But if you don't specify, will it not wait?
It's a question. If I don't specify
the return,
if I don't specify the return, if I specified a return value in something here, it would put the return value in there. But it would wait regardless. Is that your question?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the most straightforward fix, is wait for the thread we started to actually finish before we return from main and exit the process. There's another version way you can fix this, which I don't recommend, is that there's a pthread exit function, which exits the current thread without exiting the process. And you can call it from the main thread. Because we're not returning from main in this case, the print message thread will keep going. Okay, so we have our two functions, so pthread join. So pthread exit is basically the thread equivalent of the exit function. But unlike exit, it only exits one thread, not the whole process. And the argument it takes is the value to return from that thread as if it was returned from the main thread's function, like what print message returns as its return value. Questions on pthread join and so on? Yes?
Just a question about the main. Is the main its own thread?
The question is, main is running its own thread? Yes. Every process in POSIX starts with one thread that's running main.
So the process would be that whole program. Like that whole.
So the question is, the process would include all the threads you created, if that's what you're asking.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Exit.
The question is, it went after you pthread exit all the threads. Will the process exit? Yes.
With what status?
I don't know. Yes.
If you were to pthread create two threads and join them, do you have to do it in one statement or two statements?
The question is, if I want to join two threads with pthread join, do I have to do that with two statements? You have to do it with two calls to pthread join. It could be in a loop, but you have to have two calls. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen how to run threads. But so far, my threads have been doing some fixed work. And this is actually inconvenient for a lot of things, because often we want to start a bunch of threads which are doing similar but different things. And to do that, we're going to start passing things as the argument. We're going to use that argument in order to have threads that do different things. And I'm going to start with a simple example of a task we might want to use threads for, which is I'm going to sum 1,000 numbers using multiple threads. And I'm going to start by saying I'm going to start two threads, have each of them sum 500 of those numbers, and then I'm going to add up the partial sums at the end. And I could write two functions, one to sum up the first 500 numbers of an array, and one to sum up the second 500 numbers of the array. But your instinct should tell you maybe I should have one function for this. So instead, I have one function, which is going to handle both cases. And it's going to use its argument to figure out, am I thread 0 or thread 1? If I'm 0, I'm going to sum up 0 to 500. If I'm 1, I'm going to sum up 500 to 1,000. And to run this, we're going to pass the index 0 or 1, convert it to a pointer. So we're going to We're going to pretend it's a pointer, but really we're just storing the address 0 or 1 in the pointer to indicate which thread number we are. I guess, I was talking about adding. This example is not actually adding, it's doing something for every element of the array. But adding would be an example of a thing you could do. So questions on this? Yes.
What is a void pointer?
So the question is, what is a void pointer? So a void pointer is a pointer to anything. So the purpose of it is that you cast whatever type of pointer you have to a void pointer, and then you cast it back from a void pointer to the type of pointer you actually want. Okay, other questions? Okay. So that's our thread IDs. So here I have each thread is doing exactly half of it, and I'm starting exactly 2 threads. If we think about, I have a multi-core machine, maybe I want this code to work no matter how many cores I have and let you figure out how many cores I want to use. So let's make this more generic by, instead of always starting 2 threads, I'll have a vector of thread IDs down here, and I'll store a global with the number of threads, and I'll have each of these threads compute what part of the array they want to work on based on their number, their index, and the total number of threads we want. Yes?
So what's the thing that gets stored in threads I?
So the question is, what's the thing that gets stored in threads I? This is the idea of the thread, which is like a process ID. Yeah, this is this I. Uh-huh. It's literally just a copy of that I. Is what this thread ID I'm extracting is. If we wanted to get the pthread t for a thread, there's a function called pthread self for that. And that's basically the thread equivalent of get pid. And just like if we were starting multiple processes, what your PID is doesn't tell you if like it's the first process in the pipeline or the second. Okay, other questions? Okay, so yeah, I have highlight. So yeah, the I is what becomes that thread ID. Because we're casting I to a void star and then casting it back to an int when it gets passed as the argument to the new thread. The threads of I is what we're going to use to call pthread join, because it expects the thread actual, PID equivalent. Okay. Now, you might say, this code is awfully ugly because I was told to not use global variables. Why are we using global variables? Can we avoid that? And the answer is, yes, you can. You don't need global variables. So here, I'm passing a class. So I just have a class I've defined. I make a new instance of the class, pass a pointer to that, and we extract the pointer from the void star, and then delete it when we're done with the thread. And I can put whatever I want inside that. So, anything you want to pass to your new thread, even though it's only a void star, shouldn't have a problem doing that. Questions on this pattern here? Okay. Yes. Why am I deleting it? Because it's the pointer I created with new here, and something has to delete it. So I've chosen to delete it from the thread. Yes. So the question is, we don't need a global variable because of the argument? Yes, because you can pass a pointer to whatever information you want in the argument. Other questions? Yeah.
For that bullet pointer, you can cast that to an int or pretty much whatever you want to.
Question is for the void pointer, you can cast it to pretty much anything. You can always cast it to any pointer type. And most integer types are safe to store in a void pointer. Okay, so now that we've looked at sort of basic how to create threads, how to wait for threads, how to pass data to threads, here's a little exercise. What's wrong here? This code has a big problem. And it's not that main doesn't return. That is fine. So here I'm using the version of pthread join which retrieves the return value. So I'm retrieving what's returned into the string pointer, which I'm passing a pointer to the pointer because we're going to fill in string pointer. Oh, if you're pointing, yes, and I, yes, create, okay, so someone I overheard, yes, I probably meant to do this. That is also not one of the, that's not the intended problem, but it is a big problem. It is indeed a big problem that I should have been consistent. So, someone want to tell me a big problem besides my misnamed function? Yes.
You're returning a reference to a local variable.
Yes. So, this is a problem you hopefully vaguely remember from 2150. We're returning a pointer to a local variable. Your question is, where is that stored? Well, it's stored on the stack of our thread we created. So, that stack is going to be allocated when we create the thread. And it's going to go away when the thread finishes. So we can't use that point. So that pointer we have now points to some deallocated memory, and we try to print that out. So that's not going to work out very well. Okay, so questions? Okay, and we can see from this, incidentally, that one of the things we have to do when we create a thread, something that's happening underneath, is that we're allocating a new stack for the thread, where that object was, which gets deallocated somehow, along with its thread control block and all that information. And something to note, that one reason we talked about join, so with pthreads, the stack and the control block might not be fully deallocated until you call join. Like, at the least, it needs to keep around that return value pointer until you call join. It won't keep around what it points to automatically. That's your job. But it will keep around the pointer, so it will waste memory until you call join, just like wait PID. You need to call that to retrieve the return value, or else the operating system is going to track it until you call wait PID. Now, unlike with what we know about WaitPID, there is a way that's relatively simple to say, I created a thread. I don't want to join this thread. Just run it in the background. I don't care about what it returns. I'm never going to look at that return value. And this is pthread detach. So pthread detach says, I don't want to join this thread. Just forget about it. Just let it finish and then forget about it. OK. questions? Yes. Yeah.
Does that deallocate everything?
So the question is, does it deallocate everything? So this ensures that when the thread's done, yeah, any memory it used is deallocated. Any resources kept around to track the thread should go away. You can also, instead of calling pthread detach, you can use that attributes argument I previously set as null. You can set that up to say, start this thread as detached already, rather than me calling pthread detach. Another thing you can do with that attributes argument is, we said, it allocates a stack. And you might say, well, how big are the stacks? You know, you're used to the idea of our picture is like the stack is just all of the memory. We clearly can't do that. And what POSIX does is it, you know, implementations choose a size. And if you don't like their choice, you can make your own. So you can say, I want a 32 kilobyte stack. And that's another use of those attributes. So questions? OK, so we've seen basic threads. So I'm going to go through just reviewing, now that we know about passing values, just going through our, we went through our examples of how we pass values. So here, I'm going to run a bunch of threads and use global variables. And my technique that I am have this argument, which tells me the thread and the index of the thread. So this is one way we can do it. So here I have, I'm doing my sum. I have my partial results, two of them, and my total sum. And you know, I store the result in there. So I have a write to the appropriate sum. And using this, I have this sum using multiple threads. I create two threads. Then I join the two threads, and then I sum up the results that they stored in that global variable. Okay. Questions about how this code works? So another thing I could do is I could have the information for the threads. Rather than having them use a global variable for storing the results, I could pass them a struct. And in this case, I haven't even nuded the struct. I just have an array of these on some old stack. And I'm passing a pointer to that. And that is fine. And each thread reads from the pointer to get the start and end location, and writes using that pointer to write the result. And in the end, we just add the two results together. And because the array of info is a local variable, it will automatically be deallocated when sumAll exits. And fortunately, we know that sumAll is going to wait for both of the threads, so we don't have to worry about the threads using it after it goes away, like our previous example. Questions? Here. So, and we have our global values. So a way we can view this is that we have our main thread has an info array. Both of our threads have a local variable that points to that on the other stack. And we also have a global array of values in our data area. And we could extend this a little bit to get rid of that global array by passing a pointer instead, the same place we passed the start and end in that array from the main stack. So here I have two copies of the pointer, one for each thread, along with their start and end locations and a place for them to store the results. So questions? And anything this code does? So here we have our each thread has a pointer to that array, and that array has pointers to values, which was who knows where that is. Could be on the stack, could be on the heap. Doesn't matter. And another thing we could do is we could say, I don't want to store things on the main thread stack. I want to like have a separate start doing the sum, finish doing the sum function. And we can do that by just by allocating this on the heap, this array on the heap, but doing the same thing we would do otherwise. And we also need to track the thread IDs to join them. So I just said, well, I'm already tracking the start and end locations. I might as well just put the thread ID next to it. And now I have this separated out into two functions and all the values, which you know, we can call at any time. We don't have to worry about things going out of scope because everything is important on the heap. Okay. So questions about how this works? And I'm pointing this out because, well, I want to point out you, there are lots of common patterns like this for how do I do a bunch of stuff in lots of threads? Well, these are the sorts of ways you can pass values around and keep track of them and wait for them. And something you'll also notice here is that I talked about how we get like return a value from a thread and retrieve it with pthread join, and I'm not using it in any of this code. In fact, this is pretty common in code that uses pthreads, that it will get the return value in some other way like this. Any questions about this? Okay. So we've introduced you to pthread create and pthread join, and all these functions can have errors, and almost all the code I'm going to show you is not going to do any error checking, but you should. So you can have errors like we're out of memory, or you've reached the limit on the number of threads you can create, or you passed an invalid pointer, you know, things like that. And the way it works for pthread create and pthread join, unlike the other POSIX functions you're used to, is the return value is non-zero if there's an error, and the return value's number indicates what error it is. It's not going to be negative one like you've seen with fork and wait PID and so on. So your actual pattern should be check the error return value. If it's not zero, do something. Okay. So any questions about? Okay. So now that we know how to use threads in some basic way, we're going to want to talk about how to make them actually do the right thing. And a big problem with threads is that because the scheduler decides when your threads run, it can make different decisions based on things which are effectively random to you, like things that you don't, you know, when keys are pressed and all sorts of things that are out of your control. And also, like, if you have multiple cores, the cores might run at slightly different speeds. And this means it's hard to figure out, does this program that uses threads work correctly all the time, or is sometimes it going to break? So we're going to want to have building blocks that are going to guarantee correctness. But first, we're going to look at how we can have some problems. I'm going to start with a classic type of example, which is, let's say we have an ATM server. It takes commands as from clients of withdraw or deposit between, you know, from an account or to an account. And our correctness goal is don't lose money. And let's say our server looks like this. It gets a request and does the operation based on it, and we have code like this. We get an account, which is represented by some struct. We manipulate the struct and say to store the account afterwards. And you know, this is single-threaded. This is one thread, but maybe you want this to be multi-threaded because maybe get an account and store account are slow, so you want to run multiple copies of that loop at the same time. So we can handle multiple requests at once and hide the fact that get account sometimes takes a while because it has to like read a file or something like that. So we'll have many threads all running the same server loop. So we'll just have this loop where we create a whole bunch of server loop threads and do that. Okay. So this is the structure of our server. And now we have a problem. So let's say I deposit to the same account twice from different places. So one thread gets one deposit command, the other thread gets the other. And let's say we even have one core. We don't even have multi-core. So here's our plus equals. We get the account balance, we add amount to it, and we move it back into the account balance. This is what our compiler generated. It's correct code for that plus equals statement. And now even on one thread, we just have some very unlucky context switches. And it ends up that the value that thread B computes is the one that gets stored, not the value that thread A computes. So thread A's adding of amount doesn't happen in our result. Only thread B's amount gets added, not both. So we've lost money, which we definitely don't want to do. You know, just lose track of whatever the amount deposited was for in the thread A's command. And this is even though it's just one plus equal statement, the problem is that that's got split up into separate instructions. Yes?
If it was add instead of move, would it, could there not be one cell long?
The question is, if this was one instruction, one add instruction, would we have no problems? And the answer is, we wouldn't have problems on a single core, but it turns out we will have problems. And I'll explain why later. But first, let's think about sort of the sample case. Let's think about like what happens when we have these competing threads acting on this overlapping values. So first of all, let's start with our sort of base case. I have thread A assigning 1 to X and thread B assigning 2 to Y. What are the possible values of X after both threads run? This is the gimme, simple one. One. It can only be one because thread B doesn't touch X. Okay. So okay, here's the non-gimme. Here I have initially X and Y are 0, and thread A assigns Y plus 1 to X, and thread B assigns 2 to Y, and then assigns Y times 2 to Y. What are the possible values of X? Someone, so volunteer back there.
Five.
So you say 5. So is that the only value? Okay. Someone give me another possible value of X. Yeah.
3.
Any others? Yeah.
1.
Okay. So 1, 3, or 5, and we got this because you're the way you think about this. If you say, we're going to do this, what thread A's work is either going to go here, here, or here. If it goes here, we get 1. If it goes here, we get 3. If it goes here, we get 5. Yeah?
Is it possible for B to finish before A even starts?
It is, in which case we would expect 5. Questions? Yes.
Why
was
it just one?
What? So the question is, why is the answer to this one just one? Because thread A doesn't care about Y. So how about here? What are the possible values? Yeah. You say 1 or 2. So that is the most sensible answer. Now, I haven't really given you enough information, though. Like, let's say we set the values bit by bit. Why can't it be 3? Like, maybe they set them in different orders, and we can end up with 3. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't seem like it's likely. So we're going to want to have some assumptions on what things happen all at once. we're going to have this notion of an atomic operation. So this is something which happens all at once or not at all, that it's not going to be split up into pieces. And this is going to be important when we talk about threads, because we want to know that when this thread does something, another thread doesn't do something in the middle, that we don't have a case like our assignment where somehow the assignment has multiple pieces, so we can end up with results like 3 or 0, because it's done bit by bit and possibly in different orders. And on most machines, loading and storing words, meaning word being the whatever the machine's natural register size is, so like on a 64-bit machine, a 64-bit value, is atomic, meaning that, yes, 1 or 2 is what you would get, not 3, not 0. It has to be one of those two. And you might say, well, yeah, but just instructions are atomic. And you get that idea because in our single core case, all you have to worry about is context switching. But some instructions are not atomic. And one example of a non-atomic instruction is the x86 add to memory instruction, the one that someone wanted to use to add to our balance to avoid that lost write problem. So as a demo, here's a program I wrote. I have a loop in assembly here. I have a global variable called the value, and I'm using a single instruction to add one to it. And then I have my loop counter, which is the first argument. I decrement that, and as long as it's greater than 0, I keep doing this. So if we pass 1,000,000, I'm going to add 1,000,000 times to that global variable. And then return. And I have my main function here, where I start two threads that run this update loop function with the argument 1,000,000 and wait for them to complete. And if each add actually was atomic, you'd expect a result of 2,000,000, that there's 1,000,000 adds that happen in thread A and 1,000,000 adds that happen in thread B, and the overall result of that is that we have 2,000,000 as the answer. And that is not the result I get running on my desktop. So in fact, I ran this a lot of times on my desktop, and I have a histogram of the results I got. Here's just what it looks like. And this may not match your intuition for what should have happened. Like, you probably thought, okay, maybe the processor does the add in a couple steps, so we're going to sometimes miss a few adds. You probably didn't think we're going to usually get only around one of the thread's adds. And you probably really didn't think we're sometimes going to get less than 1,000,000. Yeah. The x-axis is the result, yes, and the y-axis is frequency. So, yes, it really is not atomic. And this is because I had multiple cores. Because on a single core, we can't interrupt that add instruction, but in the hardware, the add instruction, that complicated add to memory instruction, is probably implemented by doing it in multiple steps, and those steps, you know, can happen at different times because the processor wants to run instructions quickly. So it probably turns it into a load and add and a store. And also there's some other stuff going on that we'll talk about later with how caches work and for multiple threads. But the key thing is that if it's not atomic, the processor, you know, it's not going to act as if we interleave the instructions. You're going to have some in-between results, like you see here. And, like, intuitively, what's probably happening is that the processor says, oh, it's quicker to keep this value around in the cache of this core rather than write it back to memory. So I'm going to do the calculation locally, then store that result. It's probably basically what's happening and why we usually get around 1,000,000. So you might say, if add is an atomic, how do I know what is atomic? So we'll assume loads and stores of words are, but if you actually need to know this in the real world, the processor designer better tell you. They better document it. It's their job to make things work atomically sometimes and to tell you when they've done that. Okay, so questions about atomic operations. So we're going to look into, well, given that we know loads and stores are atomic, we're going to want to have two threads agree to keep it be in sync with each other. And we're going to start with a human synchronization problem, which is that we want Alice and Bob are two roommates, and they want to keep their fridge stocked with milk. And they, you know, what they do naturally is that they independently, like two different threads, look to see if there's milk. If not, they go to the store and buy it, get it back. And we have this problem that, well, it turns out that Alice might decide to buy milk at the same time Bob does, and you end up with a fridge full of milk. So we want some solution to this, and to solve this, we're going to have to communicate. So we're going to have Alice and Bob write notes to each other, and we can think of the notes as our memory locations that we're loading and storing from. We store to write a note, we load to read a note. So here's our simple solution that we're going to check if there's no milk. Then we're going to check if there's no note saying I'm getting milk. And if not, we're going to leave a note, go by milk, and remove the note after we got the milk. And this seems like a sensible solution. This is what you would tell someone if they couldn't figure out how to coordinate with their roommate to buy milk to do. But unfortunately, computers are not going to execute this like humans would. So this is not going to actually work if we like translate this to the computer version. And here's an example of why. So Alice goes and says, oh, there's no milk. Looks for a note. There's no note. Hi, Bob. Then Bob looks for milk. There's no milk. Looks for a note. There's no note. Hi, Alice. And then Alice leaves a note, buys some milk, removes the note. Bob gets distracted for a little bit, then leaves a note, buys some milk, and removes the note. So this is the problem. So these instructions, when we translate it to our load store language, it doesn't actually work out correctly because we don't have an equivalent of hi Alice, hi Bob to figure out that maybe we shouldn't believe that the lack of a note means we don't need to buy milk. So we need some solution to this. So you might imagine, okay, so the problem here is that we should leave a note to indicate we're checking so Bob doesn't actually check while we're checking. So let's do that. Let's leave a note first, then see if there's milk, then see if there's no other note. Then see if there's no note and do that by milk. That has the major problem that we left a note. So we're going to lever by milk. So you might say, okay, we should remember which notes we wrote. So we'll leave a note from Alice. Okay, so we solved that problem. So like the dumb version here, like we're just saying, is this a no? Well, there's a no. That's silly. So let's not be silly and say, I'm going to leave a note and say it's from Alice. So that's like store Alice as the value of something. And then I'm going to check if there's no milk. And I'm going to check if there's no note from Bob. And if so, I'm going to buy milk. And then I'm going to remove my note from Alice. And this seems like it ought to work. You know, so now we don't have to worry about looking at our own note and saying we don't need milk, because we remember who the note comes from. And we can do this with like separate variables for each note. But it turns out that this still has a problem. And you might ask, like, well, what's the problem here? Well, here's an example timeline. So Alice leaves a note, checks if there's milk. And then Bob comes along, hi Alice. And Bob leaves his note. Alice sees if Bob has a note and finds out, well, she doesn't. Well, he does have a note now, so I don't need to check if there's milk. And then Alice gets distracted for a while. And Bob checks if there's milk. There's no milk, but there's a note from Alice still because Alice hasn't removed it yet. She got distracted. Then Bob decides not to buy milk, removes his note, Alice removes her note. No one buys milk. We have too little milk. And you can see, like, so I've like figured this out in advance. You could figure out that these sorts of scenarios would happen. Basically, what you do is you go figure out all the possible ways we can interleave things. Like, what if we wait? What if Bob leaves a note right here? What if Bob leaves a note right here, right here? You just enumerate all of those, and that's how you would find these broken cases. So that's how you test this. I've just shown the results of testing it, where we just go through carefully and try setting up all the setting up a time which will cause a problem, and we can just enumerate all those times. So we have a systematic way of, given some proposed method for agreeing to buy milk or not, of figuring out why it didn't work. But we still haven't figured out, like, is there actually a way of doing this? Like, I've shown you that all these expansions on the approach, you know, keep not working. Like, is there something we can do where we're using this idea of having notes and checking notes that will actually result in us correctly buying one thing of milk every time? Yes?
Yeah, I mean, why would you ever let there be two notes on the fridge? So, you know, if you see a note on the fridge, there's no need to put your note down.
So the question is, can't we just have an operation which is put a note on the fridge only if there's not one there? That is indeed a nice idea, but unfortunately, it doesn't have a good analog to our loads and stores of words. There's not an operation like storing which also checks what was previously there. But you are hinting at what our solution will be for this, is that the hardware is going to provide us with something like that operation. But it's not, it's going to be more complicated than a load or a store. Other questions? So with the only reading or writing notes, it turns out there is a solution to this problem that is correct. I am not going to show you why it's correct. I'm not going to show you, you know, explain that. But there is a solution, and here it is. So Alice leaves a note, and she repeatedly checks if there's a note from Bob. And while there is, she just waits until the note goes away. And then she checks if there's no milk, and if not, she buys milk, and then she removes her note. And Bob leaves a note, checks if there's no note from Alice, and if so, checks if there's no milk, and if so, buys milk, and so on. And the most non-obvious thing we did here is we needed to have one person designated as waiting for the other to make this work. And this is not an obvious solution. Proving correctness, like, basically you want to enumerate all the possible times during which Bob could leave his note and keep going to figure out, show it's correct. That would be, there might be a more systematic way. I'm not going to have you do that, but I assert that someone has done this work and it actually is correct, I hope. And another thing you might want to do is say, well, this works for Alice and Bob. What if we have three people? How do we make this work with three people? And that's not obvious. There is a way of doing it, but it's not obvious. If you want to look up how to do it, look up something called Peterson's algorithm. We will not use this. We're going to use special hardware support instead. So we're going to have the equivalent of leave a note, but check what the previous note was atomically operation, which is a big thing we were missing. We could only check if there was a note and leave a note as separate operations. And that's where we got into all this trouble. That something happened between when we left our note and when we checked for a note. And that's like all this work is about dealing with that. But we're going to use special hardware support instead. I'll talk about what that special hardware support is probably next week. But first we're going to talk about what the result of that special hardware support is. And that's going to be this nice abstraction that's going to give us a property known as mutual exclusion. That one thread is going to do a particular thing at a time. So in our example, we wanted one person at a time to check for and buy milk. We wanted that whole operation to be one at a time. So mutual exclusion is our name for ensuring that one thread does a thing at the same time. And we're going to call the thing that each thread does one at a time a critical section. This is a vocabulary term. I'm mentioning it because you will probably see it in the real world, maybe. And we're going to have an abstraction to implement mutual exclusion or make some code into a critical section called a lock. And a lock is this object which one thread can hold at a time. The idea is you take the lock, and when you do, no one else has the lock until you're done with it, and that provides mutual exclusion. And if you always take the lock before you run a piece of code, that code turns into a critical section. And only one thread will run that piece of code at a time. And in this case, we want to take the lock and hold it while we're checking if there's if we need to buy more milk and buying more milk. So it's basically the working version of those notes. And we give it up after we're done. So with that, our usage would be we're going to lock or acquire is their name for getting the lock, and release or unlock is for ungetting it. And you know, our operation is get this lock for who's checking for milk, see if there's no milk. If so, buy some, then release the lock. And the way this lock will work is that if this is Alice, if Bob comes along and tries to get the lock, Bob won't finish locking it until after Alice has unlocked it. And that makes sure that Bob won't check if there's milk until after Alice has done the buy milk operation. Okay. And to make this work, everyone needs to agree to use the lock before using that shared resource. That's part of how this works. If you forget, if you like just buy milk randomly without acquiring this lock, well, of course you're going to have too much milk. You have to actually, everyone has to follow the rule that this shared thing, we always check the lock to make sure we actually have a critical section. And locks actually exist in pthreads. So pthread has something called a mutex, which is a lock. And I'm showing you the syntax here. So there's an init function, which turns a uninitialized, in this case, variable milk lock into an initialized mutex. This null argument is attributes, settings for the mutex. I'm just using the defaults. And there's a lock operation and an unlock operation. And the lock operation, it's going to have your thread go to sleep if someone else has it locked until they unlock it. So you'll wait until someone unlocks it if it's already locked. And if not, you'll just get the lock and prevent someone else from locking it until you're done, until you unlock it. XV6 also has locks. It has something called, it calls spinlock, which has an initlock function, which takes a name which is printed out for some debug messages if some things fail, and has an acquire for its equivalent of lock and release for its equivalent of unlock. And we saw this earlier when we talked about the scheduler code. So this is what XV6 uses to make sure when someone's marking a process as runnable, there's not another thread which is going to try to check what processes are runnable at the same time and get confused about which when things are runnable or not. Okay, so questions? Yes?
If you have multiple threads trying to acquire the lock, is it like a queue of who's waiting next for the lock, or is it kind of this?
So the question is, when multiple threads call lock or acquire, you know, who gets the lock when? And both XV6 spin locks and pthread mutexes don't specify. They just specify that, you know, they'll get them in some order. They don't say what order. Probably it would be best if they got it in approximately the order that they're requested, but XV6 spin locks make absolutely no attempt to make this happen. And pthread mutexes sometimes might attempt to make that happen, but it's not consistently done across OSs. The only guarantee is that, like, if you're the only one waiting, you definitely get it. If there's multiple threads waiting, one of them will get it. Next. Yes.
So can you use mutex lock in XV6 or only spin lock?
The question is, can you use mutex lock in XV6? No. You can, inside the XV6 kernel, you can only use spin lock because there's no P threads in XV6. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, do you have to destroy spin locks you create? The answer, I think there's no dynamic memory in the spin locks in XV6. But generally, most of the spin locks are in global variables, so it doesn't matter. And if you create a new one, it will probably be a global variable. So there will be no reason to ever destroy it. Other questions? Okay. Oh, something I'd like to note about pthread mutex locks. In addition to init like this, there's an alternative you can do, which is you could say, I should do it up here, you could do melc lock equals pthread mutex initializer, or just a special constant that you can initialize it with instead of calling the init function. So that's an alternative. If you don't have an obvious place to call init, you can use that special constant, which I just skipped out back from. So sybil bolt to init. So either call init or use that special initial value like you would assign to a number. Okay, so another thing, since we talked about locks and using things for multiple threads, one place this comes up a bunch in some assignments and in the real world is like, if you want to write C++ code, you like have a shared vector, a vector that's in a global variable. Good question is, can you use that for multiple threads? And this depends, right? Maybe the vector uses locks inside it, and it's perfectly fine. Maybe it doesn't. So you have to ask the C++ library authors what happens, and they have made a deliberate choice. So if you think about how a vector works, you have a dynamically allocated array, and as long as that's not being reallocated, it should be fine for multiple threads to read from it. So the rules that the C++ standard made is basically, if you have a container, like a vector, multiple threads can read from that thing at the same time, but you're only allowed to read something that no one else is modifying. If someone else might be modifying it, the container might do something crazy like move it around inside it. And you can only add or remove elements if no other threads are accessing the container at all. So if you want to append to a pushback on a vector, you can't be reading from the vector from another thread. And the reason why is because, well, the vector might be reallocated. And that would, and the rules that C++ made is that they decided we're not going to have the vector class do the extra work of making that work. Instead, you're going to have to do your own lock to prevent that from happening. Okay. So, questions? Yes.
Oh, no.
So, this is, if you want to use vector map and so on, these are the rules you have to follow. So, you basically, if you're only reading from it, don't need any locks whatsoever. If you're writing to it, you need locks, and you need locks that prevent anyone, you need to use locks so that no one else reads while anyone's writing. And if you're reading, and you can modify elements as long as no one else is reading from the element. But changing the size, that counts as changing the whole vector or map or whatever. Okay, so finally, we saw the abstraction for locks. I'm going to talk about implementing locks in the simplest possible case. And that's on a single core system. And on a single core system, the only way we stop running a thread is that we have some exception happen. And if it's an exception that we don't trigger, it's an interrupt, like timer expiration or a key press. So the simplest way we can implement that lock abstraction is disable interrupts while it's locked, re-enable them when we're done. And in fact, on x86, there are instructions to do this. And in fact, this is part of how XP6's spin lock works. It uses these instructions. Okay. Now, you might say, OK, so here's my lock implementation. Lock is disable interrupts. I don't even care what you're locking. I'm just disabling interrupts. We only have one core. There's not, you know, that stops you, whatever is it you're worried about needing a lock from doing anything. So no one else is going to try to acquire the lock while you have interrupts disabled because no one else gets to run. And we re-enable them when you're done. And this is enough for a single core, except that there are some side effects of disabling interrupts which may be less than desirable. Can someone think of any problems that this would have practically? Yes? Okay, so what if you provide this API to user programs, they could just never unlock, in which case they'll hang the system, you know, or you know they just have an infinite loop. So this might be acceptable inside the kernel where you trust all the programmers to hopefully have make sure they always unlock, but it's not acceptable for something like pthread mutex where we're going to give this to random programmers. And we don't want them to hang the whole system. Yeah?
You won't accept keyboard or mouse input.
Another problem is that to process keyboard or mouse input, we need to get an interrupt. So if our idea is we're going to lock and then read from disk with the lock, because you want to be the only one, you know, processing a file, it's not going to help us with that, because the read will never finish. So, you know, we're going to need something else. Okay. Any other issues? Okay. So there's one more subtle issue with this, which is if we think about nested locks, that we might have two locks we're using, and unlocking any one lock with this code unlocks all the locks. So this is the opposite kind of problem. The other problems were we were hanging. This problem is that we're actually not enforcing the critical section property. We're letting two threads run the same code even though there's a lock. And that's because we enable interrupts. Now, this last problem, there's an elegant fix to. The other problems, we're going to have to do something different. But for this last problem, what's the fix? What should I do instead to deal with nested locks? So, yeah?
Just don't nest your locks.
So don't nest my locks. Let's say I'm implementing the lock function, and I have to deal with people using nested locks. Is there something I can do about that? Yeah. What do you mean? I, the implementer of the lock function?
Or like, could you have just like different levels of like?
So different levels. So I could track, yeah, so I could track a level. So I could say, here I'm at level 1, here am I at level 2, here I'm down to level 1, and I could say, if I'm not down to level 0, don't enable interrupts yet. That makes sense? Questions? Scheme? So basically, it's, you know, level plus plus and disable interrupts, and here it's level minus minus, and if level is 0, then enable interrupts. Otherwise, don't change them. So that's a working scheme that handles nested locks, and this is in fact exactly what this is part of what XP6's spin lock does. It implements exactly this scheme of tracking this level number and only enabling interrupts when we get down to the last level, so you can have nested locks. And if you look at the code for acquire and release, one of the things they do is this push CLI and pop CLI, and they implement that algorithm. CLI is the clear interrupt enabled. That's what the name comes from. It's based on the instruction. But they disable interrupts on acquire, re-enable them on release, but they do it in a way which handles nested locks correctly, so they only re-enable them the last nested lock. Now, there's a bunch of other code, which we'll talk about next time, which handles, what about multicore? What do we do on multicore? And we'll talk about that a lot next week.